Today's program was brought to you by New York Wines, reminding you to eat and drink local this Thanksgiving. For more information, visit newyorkwines.org.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 191 of The Morning After. I'm your host, Sari Kamen. I am here in studio in the back of Roberta's, live in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And my guest today is Dr. Krishnendu Ray. Hello.
Hi, Sari.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Dr. Ray is the Associate Professor and Department Chair of the Food Studies Program at NYU. He is the author of several books dealing with ethnicity and culture and food, so we have a lot to talk about. First, before we delve into that, Dr. Ray, should I call you Dr. Ray? Do you prefer that? Do you prefer Krishnendu?
Krishnendu
is fine.
Chris
okay.
is fine.
That's what I called you in school, but you know, we're on the radio now, so it feels very formal all of a sudden. some very interesting food news. I don't know if you've been in anticipation of this all your life like I have, but the world's first blue wine has finally... Yeah,
yes.
I know. Isn't that great?
It is great.
Just in time for Trump's America comes blue wine that feels suddenly not like a coincidence. I did not vote for blue wine. So apparently it's the combination of certain red and white grapes with organic pigments and flavors has produced a sweet, shockingly electric blue wine. And this has been developed by a Spanish company of all companies. I don't know. I feel like I would never drink that. Would you try it?
I'll try.
You would? Would you try anything?
Yeah, I'll try anything once.
It's like amazing that people were actually putting resources towards this. They've been working on it for over 2 years, which I didn't know there was like a void in the wine world in terms of color. But the more you know. All right. Speaking of more horrifying products in the food world, Israel has developed a Coca-Cola bottle that is also a selfie stick, I should say.
Oh. Wonder, have you seen what it looks like?
Yeah, it looks like a bottle of Coke, and at the bottom there's like this red thing that actually has like a little camera in it. So adding to the list of like things we didn't know we needed in the food world. And if you lift it up to like a certain degree, it automatically takes a picture. Because what did we need when we were drinking Coke was like more photographs of ourselves. Yes. So thanks, Israel. It's great. And then let's see. Oh, yeah. So a woman has sued Krispy Kreme over fake ingredients. I don't know. Like she's
that's good.
Oh, it's a man actually. It's not a woman. Sorry. A man in California. He's filed a lawsuit because apparently the maple icing he's discovered does not have maple in it. And the blueberry flavored bits are artificial.
What a tragedy.
What a tragedy. I know. Well, good for you. Good luck. We had some law cases last week about food. Actually, like the past 2 weeks, someone sued KFC over not having like a bucket that was as full as the picture showed.
Good. Our standards are kind of getting stringent.
You're right. Yeah, discipline. Well, they showed them. Oh, all right. I'm done with that. We're going to take a break. We'll be back with Krishnendu Ray.
Thanksgiving is a great time to support New York farmers, including local wineries. Find great white wines, red wines, and rosés from Long Island, the Hudson River region, the Finger Lakes, and beyond at New York City wine shops and restaurants. This Thanksgiving, New York Wines is proud to partner with Fleischer's Craft Butchery, which supports local farmers raising heritage breed turkeys in New York State. With a healthy dose of ingenuity and a collaborative winemaking culture, the number of wineries in New York has grown exponentially over the last 10 years, as has the quality of the wines they produce. New York is a world-class wine region offering quality, variety, and value. The perfect trifecta for a bountiful Thanksgiving feast. For information on more than 400 New York wineries, please visit newyorkwines.org.
Hey, you're listening to The Morning After on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sari Kamen, and I'm in studio today with Christian Duray. He is an associate professor and the department chair of the Food Studies program at NYU. He's also the author of The Migrants Table and The Ethnic Restaurateur. Welcome to the show again,
you,
Christian
Du.
Very happy to have you here. I asked you to come on because you were my professor in grad school, so I'm a big fan. Just a little transparency there. because you're an author and you've written a lot about food and ethnicity, and I thought that in the wake of the election, it would be interesting to have you come on and talk about just your perspective on what it's like, first of all, I guess, to be an immigrant. How does it feel? I know you immigrated to the United States from India in the late 80s.
Yeah, I joke a little when I say my son is my anchor baby because he's the citizen in the household.
Mm-hmm.
And I have some, makes me anxious a little, but I think my concerns are trivial compared to what we're going to see for people who are kind of would be under serious pressure, people in the agricultural industry, people in the restaurant industry. And especially, for instance, the Dreamers, children of immigrants who had some relief from Obama's executive orders, and that has been promised to be reversed. And so with an incoming Trump administration, it's a serious source of worry. Not so much personally for me, or rather I would say connecting my personal worries with worries of many more people in much greater risk. And especially in the food, healthcare-related, childcare-related industries.
Mm-hmm. You have a son who you just said has benefited from the Obama administration, and he's the son of an immigrant. What did you say?
Hold on. No, he's a citizen.
He's a son. He's your son.
Yes.
I know he's a citizen.
Yeah.
How have your conversations been?
He was a big Bernie Sanders supporter, mm-hmm. like a lot of young people.
But he's not 18. He didn't vote.
In fact, the other day, I went to his parent-teacher conferences, and then we were walking back, and he had a friend, and they were chatting, and I was just following them or ahead of them. And when he left his friend, because he's going to go on a school trip to Japan, and he said, and his teacher had said, okay, the girls would be in one wing and the boys will be in the other wing. And he said, Dad, where will he be? Because he's transitioning from being a girl to a boy. Mm-hmm. What struck me was this, is it is so normal to him,
mm-hmm.
This. And it feels so normal in Manhattan, in New York City, as part of, and he was very relaxed about it. It's not a big deal. And to feel that this whole issue has been thrust back in some ways, I mean, that's the surprising thing. And he's surprised that there were at least 50% of about 50% of Americans who voted what looks like kind of to bring back issues we thought were settled. On gender, on race, on undocumented immigrants. And that is, it has been tough and worrisome and anxious. And it's the day of the elections, the day after, he was kind of surprised that Trump had won.
I mean, I think at least half of the country was very, I think
yeah.
even Trump supporters were surprised.
Yes, big city people especially, I think. And that's kind of one of the divides.
Yeah,
you know, bi-coastal, big city, mostly East Coast, West Coast. I mean, the big reversal this time was in the Midwest.
Yeah, I mean, it must be really interesting, like having only known the Obama administration.
Yes.
I mean, for us who were well alive during, you know, the Bush years and before, I think, you know, what's so hurtful is like it feels like there was a trajectory, yes, like an arc, you know, that started. I mean, obviously there was a Clinton before there was Bush, but like to go from Bush to Obama and then to feel like that was moving in a certain direction, like to go from having an African-American president to a woman president felt, it felt like a very natural like course of history. And then to have that sidetracked.
Absolutely. It's like feels like a big reversal in the direction. But yeah, then I come from India. And in India, we have seen a similar reversal. I'm born into a Hindu family. But, for instance, I was strongly opposed to Hindu nationalists coming to power in India. And they are in power, deeply entrenched. And they are doing what I fear about this country, too, that is creating a kind of a aggressive majoritarian view. And in the case of India, that only Hindus really belong to India, and Muslims and Christians are in some ways not legitimately Indian enough, the very thing we had fought against. And so for me, this feels like a series of defeats in India, in Great Britain, and now in the United States.
And France.
And France, it's going to get worse, probably. And so it reminds me of what Arjuna Padurai, a theorist, says about the fear of small numbers in democracies. The democracies, of course, are robust. There's a lot of room to do progressive work. But democracies also seem to have these anxieties about minorities. By their very nature, who are relatively few and should not, and typically not threatening, are imagined as threatening us.
I would love you to speak to that fear, because I think fear played such a huge part in the results of the election. And it's really hard, you know, from someone who lives in New York City to understand what, like, how palpable that fear is and how pervasive it is and, like, where it actually stems from. And I think a lot of this has to do with food, perhaps. Like, to live in a place like New York City, we're so exposed to so many different cultures. And, I mean, I was thinking about that today. I was, like, on a weekly, you know, from week to week, I eat so many different types of food. And you write a lot about how, like, when you eat someone's food, you're sort of directly connecting with their culture. And in other parts of the country, they don't have access anyway in necessarily to immigrants' lives and their and the fabric of their culture. And maybe that has to do with the fact that they don't have the diversity, you know, like we do walking down the street in New York City to pass by every kind of restaurant. Where do you think this fear comes from?
Yeah, I think it's
how it grows.
When you said is parts of the country where probably we don't have a kind of a everyday material engagement with difference. That's why I, in fact, think at the level of business, at the level of small business, at the level of everyday life, food and drinks are a way, other people's food and drinks are a way to engage with it and engage with difference and cultural difference and understand it and to not to be filled with disgust. You know, we have the long history of we look with great disdain with other people's food. That's one part of being human in peculiar ways. And we have gotten past that, especially, I think, the civil rights movement and the post-civil rights movement. The culture has been shaped in ways in which it is no longer legitimate to be disgusted, to be full of disdain for other people's culture. But what this election was a surprise to me was how some of that has come back in some ways. The second part is you see historical periods in which this happens repeatedly, and which is, what is ironic, in fact, I would say the last major group that was this kind of a target to our skepticism from nativists were, in fact, German Americans, which is the largest group of immigrants that have come to the United States. Almost 46 million today claim a German heritage, the very heritage from which Trump comes from, which is Trump's family. And the fact that during the First World War, between the two wars and the Second World War, the target of American nativism often were the same Germans. And in fact, that's the first time Americans talked about things like Liberty Burger, Liberty Fries, which was largely targeted against Germans. And one of the tragic things...
You mean, wait, there was Liberty Fries before there was Freedom Fries.
Yes, exactly. And this was all... And in fact, the most important second language taught in American schools was German. And in fact, not only this is 20th century. I mean, you can go all the way back to Ben Franklin. Ben Franklin, coming from Pennsylvania, was anxious that the Germans were swamping the Anglo culture, and he called them Teutonic, and he was nervous, and he called them swarthy. He didn't think about them as white people. By the way, that's also fascinating, mm-hmm. as to how whiteness is repeatedly reconstructed through American history. And yesterday's immigrant sometimes is today's nativist. And so it is there's both this pattern of we seem to get past these nativist phases, and then we reinvent them and appropriate.
Why do we have such a short-term memory?
In some ways, lack of historical knowledge. It's not realizing that we were the targets of these very things. Now we mouth about Mexican or Latin American immigrants swamping us and not learning English and forcing us to learn Spanish. All these anxieties, which is in fact inaccurate. We said the same things about the Germans between the two world wars. And there was this fear, there was this anxiety of small numbers, which Apudarai says, seems to be a kind of the other side of democracy. Democracy is about what I've always found fascinating about American food culture is how it is self-consciously American culture is also about incorporating immigrants into it, incorporating immigrant cultures into it, and very proudly so. That, I think, is very unusual by global standards. And it is done, for instance, by a number of historians from about 1950 onwards, where American history is seen as a history of immigration, okay? Yet on the other side of it is this, the dark side of it is we on one side we are so welcoming, and I'm hoping, that's still my hope, that it is so built into the American cultural DNA now, we cannot turn violently anti-immigrant. So that's kind of one of my sources of hope, and especially institutionally, the big cities would be a resource, important resource to push back if there is major anti-immigrant kind of hostility,
yeah.
if it develops.
And, I'm clinging to that.
Yeah, and city councils and mayors of big American cities have already started coming out and saying, so that's kind of the other side of the hope, that there is going to be some kind of mobilization in the big American cities because they are run on the basis of labor of immigrants who are absolutely central to urban culture in America.
Yeah, they are. I mean, restaurants really can't run without the immigrant labor that staffs them.
And that's one of the things, like,
I mean, is it really realistic?
So that's my both economic hope, and that will probably lead to some kind of political mobilization. There are about...
It pretty seems good, inevitable.
Yeah, pretty good estimate that about 7 million undocumented workers in the American economy. And most of them are in agriculture, and which is a relatively small number. There are only about a little under a million people working in agriculture. There are about 14 million people working in the food industry. And the largest group are undocumented. A substantial group is undocumented immigrants. There is no way that the American food industry will survive if the undocumented immigrants are removed from the system. So that will create the basis of a political alliance, that's my hope, between businessmen and women, small businessmen and women who are mostly in the food industry, and a kind of a via media between what Trump has promised or threatened, mm-hmm. and what he can do. I do not see how you can remove 7 million people from the American labor force and survive the economic crisis that's inevitably going to come on the back of that. Just the labor costs, you know.
It's like the least threatening contingency of our population.
Absolutely. And who work very hard.
Right.
And
who are not taking American jobs.
Yeah, not at all. Most Americans don't want these jobs.
I thought that fast food played like an interesting sort of symbolic role throughout the election. Like the pictures that came through social media with Trump with his like bucket of KFC. And do you remember, I think it was Cinco de Mayo when he like proclaimed he loved, like Mexicans were great. And he was like eating out of a taco bowl or something. Like, there was such a disconnect there.
Trump is a, kind of, in that sense, a very symbolically a retrograde figure, where he thinks, and one of his idea that industrial food, processed food, is clean and predictable.
That is so strange. Yes, I read about that, how he's like a germaphobe, so he eats fast food. Like, he actually said, because at least I know what's in it.
That's amazing. It was a good reminder to say, in some ways, I would say, one of the things we thought we had gotten past, this idea that industrial food is good and clean and hygienic and good for you. Now, we thought we had gone past that, and Trump is a terrific figure who comes in and says, that's why I eat processed food, because it's predictable and clean, the very thing that made industrialization of the food system so acceptable for so many people for such a long time. But I didn't expect that would be where we would be today.
Yeah, it's really strange. I mean, but he's also said that he wants to cut, oh gosh, what is it? I mean, in terms of like the farm bill, well, he wants to separate SNAP from the farm bill, but he also wants to cut into like food regulation.
Yes.
Which is ironic because he's so concerned about what's going into his food. But, you know, if you're removing regulations and you can't actually keep standards the way that they are in place, and I mean, there's just no way to monitor that food is going to be
that
safe.
Would be interesting to watch. Absolutely. Because he has come mostly on an anti-regulation kind of a vote.
It doesn't make any sense if he's so concerned.
It is. And maybe he'll separate it from his private, often people do, with his private and public concern. So he can buy his way out of it. So for the food safety and the food security, but will in fact deny the same for the rest of us as citizens, that we have less, if we have less regulations, and which would undermine pretty weak, relatively weak regulation in the United States, say compared to Europe and compared to other parts of the world. So that is one of the kind of, from the environmental regulation to the food safety regulation, that costs money, that requires resources from the state. And if he fulfills his promise of paring down the state, that will be a serious concern, food safety.
Yeah. And then what about removing SNAP from the farm bill?
And that would be kind of complicated, and that would break the alliance you have basically between, in fact, urban politicians for whom SNAP is an important part of the constituency, and rural politicians who represent basically those who benefit from the farmers who benefit from the farm bill. So the basic alliance there between the urban representative and the rural representative is going to be broken. It'll be very interesting to see.
It will be very interesting to see
what comes out of it.
When so much of Trump's core base are people who have been struggling economically, many of them rely on food stamps. I mean, talk about, you know, like biting the hand that feeds you.
And that's one of the peculiar things of this election of American politics, is that often we don't realize the very things, government programs, we depend on. And we will realize that once it's taken away, like it's going to happen probably with the Affordable Care Act,
Obamacare.
Too. You know, Affordable Care Act, the very same things. I mean, families are very happy with having their children, adult children, on their health insurance in the families. Mm-hmm. Families with folks with long-term health care concerns, pre-existing conditions, are very happy. But those people were never mobilized to vote for, to protect Obamacare. And I personally think they will be mobilized once it is attempted to take it away. And he will have to make a compromise. And that, I mean, that's the difference, I think.
I almost feel like that's what has to happen in order for them to recognize, like,
each of these things will have to be a fight.
Right.
And in this particular case, it will be kind of, we have to build that alliance and that mobilization for people who have benefited from Obamacare, from these various regulations. And that's the hope.
Yeah. I mean, the blind faith is really strange. I don't know where it comes from. Like, I was reading about someone who voted for Trump because he's unhappy, you know, he's unhappy, you know, with the wages he makes, unhappy with just how it's been for the last 8 years. He feels stagnant economically, but he has Obamacare. He's happy with it. And he believes that it's not threatened.
Mm.
Like, he has this faith that you know, Obamacare works for him and the other stuff doesn't. So Trump will just sort of cherry pick, you know, what goes and what stays.
I think,
despite what he said,
I think the work is cut out for the rest of us who would be forced to now show what would be the consequences of voting for Trump. In this case, the undermining of Obamacare, and it will take some doing. It'll take mobilizing. It'll take doing politics to be able to get there. Be it SNAP or Obamacare or regulations. And for instance, I'll give you another example that I am hopeful for the argument that Trump is making for a $1 trillion reconstruction kind of a project where infrastructure investment, that violates the Republican conservative promise of a smaller government. And that's one of the places, for instance, where Chuck Schumer and others are hoping to push, to be able to push Trump towards the trillion dollar, basically a job creation project. Because what has happened with a lot of Trump supporters who have voted for Trump is they have felt the consequences of globalization without any scaffolding to help them retrain. Ideally, for instance, would be if you could show impact of globalization, because we cannot stop all the aspects of globalization. And we have to build, instead, we have to help people to fight the consequences of it. And one of them is to, for instance, go to community college for free for 2 years, get retrained, get upskilled in a different skills. And that is the site where, in fact, a lot of the specifics of these cases and the politics of it is going to be sorted out over the next few years.
Hmm. What do you think is the responsibility right now of restaurateurs as far as, I guess, reassuring their workers? I mean, not necessarily just the undocumented ones, but maybe the ones that have undocumented family or just who feel personally threatened.
And I think one level, and some restaurateurs have come out doing that in some ways, saying we are not going to be basically doing policing activity. Cities have come up. So I think restaurateurs, small business people should be writing to their politicians, even if these politicians are, say, the big city politicians who know it and recognize it, because politicians always need kind of evidence of people's support. And I think that will emerge if there's kind of a serious attempt to deport immigrants.
Yeah. Do you think there will be a serious attempt?
I fear it, but I don't think it's possible to pull it off for two reasons. The economics of it, and the other is the politics of it. Americans are also quite sensitive to civil rights. I don't think that's going to go away completely, and individual rights, in spite of, remember, 50%, it's about a 50-50 divide now. And I think to be able to pull off a deportation force that is going to be invasive into cities and neighborhoods and homes is going to be very difficult and is going to be both also legally challenged. And I think culturally, politically would be a challenge to pull off. So I personally think what's going to happen is what has been happening under Obama, which is criminal undocumented immigrants would be aggressively got together and sent back, as has been happening with Obama for about 2 million people. And just, I think the Trump administration would make a bigger noise about it. And that has been quite aggressive, quite invasive, and I think he'll continue to do that. Anything beyond that, I think, is logistically difficult and politically would be counterproductive.
So nothing will change, he'll just tweet about it.
Yes. Well, that's the hope. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's always... my fear is that if it becomes even more aggressive.
It is pretty aggressive already.
It is. I mean, the rhetoric is aggressive. The symbolic violence is there. It's giving people freedom to express their worst kind of side of their personalities about it, all the anxieties. And maybe with this election over, some of that is going to calm down. That's my hope. And that it's in that sense, personally, I feel a little more self-conscious because of the way I look, is walking the streets and just listening and hearing these examples of physical assault or aggression, microaggression related to what you look like. It hasn't happened with me yet, but that's one of the sources of anxiety.
Have you had to have a conversation with your son about that?
Yeah, and I have tried not to have it, but I've kind of signaled it a little. It happened after, say, 9/11. I went out after the attack. I was in upstate New York. I went out for a drink at my kind of bar, regular bar, and the bartender who had seen me for years there said, if I were you, I would go back home. So it feels like, and as I've talked to other immigrants, it feels a little like that.
Post 9/11,
I did go home because I had an infant at home, and I felt exposed.
Yeah.
I feel a little, but again, I don't want to exaggerate my sense of anxiety about it, because I think poorer people, less Anglophone people, would be a much bigger target of this, and especially in areas of the country where there are many, many more people who voted for Trump and take his rhetoric seriously. They're in much greater danger than I am in New York City, partly because of where I am, New York City, partly because of my class background and the resources I have. So I don't want to inflate that.
I don't think you should minimize it either, though.
No, there's an anxiety in me. There is an anxiety that's related to it, because I'm also an immigrant.
Right. I mean, there were swastikas in Brooklyn Heights Park yesterday.
Yeah, and it's worrying.
Yeah, it is.
And it's important to connect these personal anxieties to larger social questions, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what I try to kind of balance between the two, between my anxieties and talking about it. And my son is very sensitive to, he is half white and half Indian, and he looks mixed race, and he has mixed race friends and transgender friends. They're very comfortable in their social world. These are not big deals. And suddenly it has all become a question of discussion now. And that is the downside of it, that it is not naturalized. The upside of it is it gives him a sense that there are risks in the world just because of what he looks like and what his father is. And that's a lesson I also learned in India, another democracy. My mother is Odia, my father is Bengali. At some points, there were these kind of violence, group violence between these communities, and I felt forced to, in some ways, say that I can be Odia and Bengali and not be partisan to any of these group identities, mobilizations. For me, that has always been one of the things about democracies that I both that makes me anxious about it. This kind of popular mobilization that we see programs, basically. You know, and the possibility of, and you have a demagogue who provides cultural resources and legitimacy for that kind of behavior.
It validates
hate, and that's scary.
It's very scary.
And that is, but it's the good side is it forces me to fight and fight back with my words, with in my community. In groups, for instance, it has made me, I work harder to work with the Street Vendor Project, for instance, which is arguing for more vendor permits for vendors in New York City. And most vendors are, many vendors are immigrants. It makes me work with organizations like refugee organizations, like Emma's Torch, or even small, beautiful for-profit organizations, like the League of Kitchens, for instance. It's made me much more sensitive to what I should be doing and brought me out of this comfortable space I thought...
We were too comfortable, perhaps.
Too comfortable. No, that we had settled these questions. Nativism would be a minor problem, that it not be a majority problem. When nativism becomes a majority problem, it's a serious threat.
Sure, because what we learned, all of the feelings that have been manifested in the past couple of weeks or throughout the election, they were already there. They've just now been validated.
Yeah, so the upside of it is at least this has come out. Now we can deal with it.
That is
if you can, if you know.
Yeah.
And the downside is I didn't realize it was so pervasive and so substantial that so many people were impacted with it. And I think the other lesson for it is also, for me, is also to reach out, build alliances with white working class folks, I think, who have been at the receiving end of globalization, at the receiving end of, in some ways, partly I think folks on the progressive left liberal wing have abandoned the white working class, especially white working class men. And we have to find ways to incorporate white working class men into our progressive political project. That, by the way, Bernie Sanders did a fantastic job of it and could have. And we needed to pay a lot more attention to it. And that has also made me conscious and self-conscious. So I, not only do I work with groups, immigrant groups, groups on the basis of race and color, but also the other side of it is the people who have appropriated this kind of violent nativist symbolic language, some way to reach out to them and connect my humanity to their humanity. I don't know how successful that'll be, but it feels threatening, and for a change, and that's surprising to me.
How can you, because this is your profession, how can you use food as a tool to connect? I don't know how you connect necessarily with white working class men this way, but I mean, just on food, a national level.
No, food is a fantastic way, because I work mostly in the politics of culture. And I have repeatedly said one of the amazing thing and the most beautiful thing about American culture is its capacity to, in fact, engage with immigrant foodways and immigrant labor force. And so in some ways, this reminds me. And one of the reasons I think my book, The Ethnic Restaurateur, has landed kind of this, I've been surprised by the response and reaction to it, partly because it has landed in this kind of a hotbed of discussion about difference, about class, race, and power in American history. And I think we have reached a kind of a fork in the path in American culture right
no
now.
No pun intended.
You know? And which direction are we going to go? Are we going to go the way we went with the, say, anti-Chinese regulation, with the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882? By the way, the last time there was a big boom in the restaurant industry, it also went hand in hand with an anti-Chinese regulation, and which was, again, the mobilization basis, class-wise, race-wise, was quite similar. We, of course, did that again with Japanese on the West Coast during the Second World War. And I think the question is not settled, and we can make an intervention. And we can make an intervention by mobilizing progressive forces, by talking about, in fact, how to scaffold people who have been at the receiving end of globalization and build political alliances around it. I'm hopeful about it, and I find, in some ways, American palates have been much more democratized and opened up, and I would say nativism would leave a bad taste in their mouth.
Once again. Yeah, I think this quest for authenticity, this like zeitgeist thing that's been happening where we just want to eat like the most authentically ethnic food possible, should be very relevant.
Absolutely. It leads to a certain kind of a familiarization of differences of, say, not only just, say, broad categories like Indian or Mexican or Chinese, but further regionalization. Mm-hmm. I think this pursuit of a more specific regional vernacular culture is a way in which we deal with cultural difference. And once we deal with cultural difference, it is very difficult to retreat back into our ghettos of saying, I don't want to eat this. I don't like those people. They eat weird food. I mean, I don't see that happening. And that's partly that disdain, disgust, and the symbolic violence that goes to that towards that kind of racial ghettoization, I don't think is as easily doable as it was in the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, or say the internment of Japanese in the during the Second World War, or the assault on German culture, in the 19th and parts of the 20th century. I don't think we will get there. I hope we won't get there as easily. And this engagement with cultural difference through food is, I think, have always been hopeful about it. That's why I'm also a little critical of excessively shrill discussions of appropriation, for instance. Mm-hmm. I think breaking through the barriers of cultural difference through language and food is a way people engage with cultural difference. And we should not be building excessive boundaries between gustatory culture and linguistic culture. So that's why, for me, that has also forced me to recalibrate my politics too, that I don't want to be too aggressive, too shrill about saying, because you are white, you should not be cooking or eating Indian food. In fact, I think it's the opposite. Mm. If you do and cook Indian food, if you do engage with that culture, you will learn something about it, and it makes you less of a nativist. So I think here that argument needs to be recuperated, that consuming cultural difference could be, not necessarily, but could be an opening to cultural democratization.
It's certainly neutralizes that fear of the other.
It has the possibility, absolutely. Yeah. And you will see, if you look at, say, even the New York Times, something, a progressive urban newspaper, look at a headline in 1888. It had a headline saying, Chinaman eats octopus.
Wow.
Like a shrill, big headline.
Yeah.
I don't think that's possible. Maybe I'm too optimistic, but I still don't think we're going to get to a place where we will look at other people's culture with disdain and disgust, which is crucial to nativism.
Yeah.
So I think engaging other people's culture, especially gustatory culture, is an opening to cultural difference, is an opening to a kind of a cultural democracy that I saw as a kid. I was growing up Hindu household, Hindu neighborhood. I would go to the Muslim neighborhood in Delhi, for instance, to eat kebabs. That didn't make me democratic, but what it did do is made it difficult for me to kind of spread scandalous rumors about what Muslims ate in India. That was an important part of an engagement with cultural difference. And I think that has always been important in the United States, and it continues to be important and would be one of the bulwarks against excessive nativist violence.
Yeah, that's powerful. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be back with the morning after quiz. We're back. This is the morning after. We've been talking with professor and author Krishnendu Rai, having a very interesting conversation about food and culture and race and politics. But now we're going to do something totally silly to wrap up the episode. It's time for the morning after quiz. I'm going to ask you three questions. Krishnendu.
Oh, no. I'm terrible at quizzes. Yes.
This is payback for when I was your student. Not that you ever really gave me any quizzes. Your last name is Ray, which you know all about. But what do you know about Ray's Pizza?
Oh, my God. No, nothing.
Rhetorical question.
No,
okay.
I don't know anything.
It's
going to
be
it.
Three multiple choice questions.
Where does the Ray come from?
That might be one of the questions. Okay. So, first of all, first question, which is not the name of a current pizza restaurant operating in New York City? A, Not Ray's Pizza. 2, or B, famous original Ray's Pizza, or C, Ray's Pizza?
Not Ray's Pizza?
No, that is the name.
Seriously?
Yes.
Wow.
Ray's Pizza is not a currently operating pizza restaurant in New York City.
Serious?
Serious. Oh, okay, gosh. Next question. The first Ray's Pizza closed, which closed in 2011. It was on 20 Prince Street, and it closed for what reason? A, the owner went to jail for his mafia connections. B, there were family legal disputes over the building it was housed in. Or C, the rising cost of mozzarella made it impossible for the business to sustain.
Wow, the family dispute.
Yes. Oh, so good. It was the family dispute.
That's good.
Okay, very good. Last question. The owner of the original Ray's Pizza on Prince Street, which was just called Ray's Pizza, was a man named Ralph Cuomo. Why did he decide to call his place Ray's? Was it A, he thought Ralph's Pizza sounded too feminine? B, it was an homage to his favorite singer, Ray Orbison. Or C, there had been a Ray's Pizza that existed before in the same space and he didn't want to pay for a new sign.
Ah, C.
No. Oh. He thought Ralph's Pizza sounded feminine.
Feminine?
Yes. I don't know why. Christian Du, thank you so much. This has just been such a wonderful, interesting conversation. Thank you.
Sorry.
Thank you for those nuggets of hope that you have offered.
Thanks.
Oh, you give me hope. Okay. We'll be back after Thanksgiving. Have a fabulous Thanksgiving. We'll be back with the morning after, the week after that, on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.